Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. As promised, Progressive Radio Network and everything else is forum, getting education, moving forward to make sure you have the knowledge, the information you need to make decisions. This evening, we're going to have a discussion about drones. And boy, you talk about a contentious issue. When you talk to some military that are on the ground, they claim that drones are saving their life. When you talk to other individuals about it and the ethics and the morality of it, it's a whole other question entirely. So let's have a discussion about drones and what's happening with them. Judy, Ed, are you with us this evening?
Yes.
Well, welcome, Judy. Ed, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Fantastic. Well, you know, when we look at all the stuff with all the drones, back some time ago when all this stuff started, there was a lot of issues and concern in the Senate Judiciary Committee. That's the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. And that subpanel came out with a real interesting decision a long time ago. Quote, an armed MQ-9 Reaper taxis down the runway in Afghanistan. The legal and defense analyst told the Senate Judiciary Committee subpanel that the use of drone strikes by the U.S. military and the CIA pushes the 2001 congressional authorization for military force to its legal breaking point. Boy, I don't think it can get any clearer than that. And every time I've read a legal decision, whether walked with the individuals who were involved in writing this stuff, they come back with the same thing. We don't have any legal authorization to be using drones. Judy and Ed, you guys are totally involved in this, aren't you?
Yes.
Well, pretty much.
Judy, could you give us a little background on drones and all what's happening and what the idea and what we need to do to, stop this nightmare? I'm in favor of stopping it because even though I understand the protective factor, this thing has turned into a tool of blatant assassination and attacks without justification.
Yes, indeed, it has. And I believe that the United States is abusing the legal system with the drones, and it's doing it deliberately. So to go back to the beginning, though, the drones have been slowly developed, actually, over the last, century, and they emerged in Afghanistan initially and Yemen during the Bush administration as a tool first for surveillance and then for essentially assassination. The thing is that even under U.S. law, assassination is illegal. So it's been a dilemma ever since for those of us who want to see the United States abide by international law and who are in conflict with a country that essentially wants to use these drones to control international law and even to change it. So just as they redefined a lot of terms to make Guantanamo supposedly legal or acceptable by renaming combatants to, something else, and generally just changing the names of people or players in a certain context, with the drones, what they're doing is they're redefining what is or isn't legal because they're saying that the drones don't fit into the pattern. So right now there's a huge campaign that the United States has globally with the drones. They're in many different countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Somalia. They're flying out of Djibouti over a variety of surveilling countries in Africa. They are flying over Iran. Iran has actually dropped a couple of them. This is a huge problem because it completely basically undermines the rule of law globally. And it puts us in a position where the United States is not only in the wrong, but it's creating a role model for other people to also be in the wrong. And it's doing it by marketing these drones internationally and by creating a situation where our rivals like Russia and China have no choice really but to build their own. So this is a huge problem, and it's safe, under the radar, so to speak, because they don't want to because it's not directly affecting us here. And for those in the service who think that the drones are a good idea to protect them, certainly having some kind of surveillance that sees all is a nice idea if you're on the ground and someone might shoot at you. But at the same time, they have to understand that, by and large, the majority of drones are not used where there are combatants on the ground. The drones are actually used for the most part in places where it's illegal to put a combatant on the ground and where there's no legal war going on.
I think one of the fascinating things, and this comes back to it, because the general public and everybody in the military has gotten into this thing where they're going to allow all this stuff to happen. And it comes back to all the stuff that charade was that took off when Operation Desert Storm, and as you and I have talked already, I'm alive today only because of the drones did surveillance, and we got warning before the Scuds and other missiles came in on us. So, I mean, I'm only alive because of that today, so there it saved my life and saved the life of the others. But we had all these wars that were make-believe, and then we went to Operation Iraqi Freedom, and during Freedom we attacked into Libya, we're attacking into Syria, we're attacking into Yemen, we've got all this stuff going in Somalia and Africa, and then up in the Ukraine and everything, where somehow the people got scared to where everybody starts allowing all these illegal operations, military operations, which are all based on control of resources, and I hate to tell you, but that's a hardcore reality, and everybody bought into these lies. And I think the drone is one of those things that's happening, because the thing that scares me and scares Robert Kaler, who an incredible investigative journalist, is the continued and increasing use of drones just for average everyday surveillance for traffic or crops or movements right here in the United States. So it's kind of like, hey, they're flying around and watching what we're doing. Big Brother, 1984. That scares me totally to death.
And it certainly should, Doug. A lot of the commercial use of drones in the U.S. will be providing cover for the kind of surveillance that the intelligence agencies and the military will be doing on us in order to suppress dissent. And, of course, it's any kind of resistant minorities that are going to get it in the neck. So, yeah, I think you ought to be concerned. I certainly am. This is invading our privacy. It's giving the government, who hasn't been too responsible in this area, you know, much more information than it should have. Do we want the U.S. government, who is so casual about law, especially overseas currently, to have this kind of tool? I don't think so. I agree with you. It's a very risky business. Now,
you know,
you mentioned your life being saved by drones, and indeed, I think some lives have been saved of people, you know, in the military. But at what expense? And how often were those lives of people that were where they should have been? Often our soldiers are put in situations where they shouldn't be, where they're breaking the law, and where their lives are sacrificed, not through any ideal, but rather to support and to enrich the 1%. We don't need drones to be enriching the 1%, either overseas or here in the U.S.
Now, I think you've got some experience on this, Ed, because you and I first met some years ago, and you were involved with Voices in the Wilderness. God bless Kathy Kelly. I mean, she is my personal hero, and I've known her for years. But you got over, actually, into Iraq, into the Middle East, and you saw what was happening firsthand, didn't you, Ed?
Well, yeah, I joined Voices in the Wilderness back in February of 2003 when the U.S. military was massing on the Kuwaiti border about to invade Iraq. At the time, we were lied to. We were told that Saddam Hussein was somehow responsible for 9/11, that Saddam Hussein had contacts with Al-Qaeda, and that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. These were all lies. And as a result, thousands of U.S. military personnel were killed outright, but also many were wounded and diseased by the depleted uranium that was used by U.S. forces, especially in southern Iraq. And I haven't even mentioned the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that have had their lives cut short by, you know, U.S. military shenanigans.
I think it had to be frightening when you were over there to see how bad. I mean, prior to Desert Storm, Iraq, and prior to all the sanctions we put on, Iraq was a first-world nation, incredible educational system, medical system, and industry and everything else. And then we virtually destroyed it all over the shenanigans and trying to control their oil and the Kuwait lies and everything. But how do you think it? How do you feel, and what did you perceive as been there and looking and watching this stuff and being active? How do you think that the average person in Iraq or these other nations feels when all of a sudden they're bombarded by the U.S. or the Western military forces without justification? I mean, what are they thinking?
Well, I'll turn that around and ask, what do you think we would feel here in the U.S. if some superpower were bombarding us? As human beings, we'd feel this is an enormous injustice, an enormous threat to our own well-being and that of our families and our communities. Well, it's the same for the Iraqis. There are people who have the same feelings and fears and desires that people here in the U.S. have. Unfortunately, people here in the U.S. have been so sheltered, so live in a bubble, that they somehow have a hard time empathizing with the people in the various countries who are under U.S. terror, airborne terror. I mean, I experienced it. I was in Iraq for about 5 months in 2003 during shock and awe. I know what it is to be fearful of terrorism from the skies. And one of the saving graces of that situation I was in was watching how the Iraqis responded. I was in a small hotel on the Tigris downtown Iraq called the El Fanar, and the Iraqis in the hotel, who are kind of used to this sort of thing, I mean, they would just with immense dignity simply file down into the basement bomb shelter. So their courage, their presence of mind, their dignity, you know, really helped those of us who weren't so experienced with this sort of thing to endure, you know, those 3 weeks of shock and awe.
Well, I think the shock and awe, and we have to understand, and some people don't understand that the military operations of attacking Iraq and the sanctions against Iraq have never stopped since the spring of 1990. I mean, continuous attacks and drones and airstrikes and everything. I know myself, I was supposed to go over there in 1998 and meet with Scott Ritter, and we were going to work on the chemical biological warfare issues over there. And everything got canceled, and Scott got ordered out of there by the U.S. military. He didn't leave there because of Iraq not denying him access or anything. That's all a lie. But then what happened is Clinton launched that massive airstrike against him. I mean, it's just been an ongoing and a nonstop thing. And now drones, I mean, they're flying a drone. A drone's an unmanned aircraft, correct? And the guys that are flying these aircraft, they're flying them from what? Back here in the United States, correct?
Yes, like at Hancock Air Base here in Syracuse, New York, where I am.
and it's worse than that, because they have a couple of guys sitting in front of the console. One is like a navigator, and the other is the pilot. And then they have other people examining the video feed at a different location, making decisions about what they think should be done. And they have other people who, you know, and they have decision makers, and they have all these different people involved. So it's kind of like, you know, I mean, I don't know how many great decisions come out of, like, committee meetings where nobody really is an expert, and no one's really on the ground to see what's going on. And so these drones are controlled in a sort of, by committee. And one of the bad things is it's kind of like a corporation, like nobody is responsible for the decision. Therefore, it's much easier for them to come up with a bad decision, in my opinion. And beyond that, they have to have information on the ground to start out. I've seen the feeds off these drones. They just aren't that clean and clear. It isn't. It's not like you can actually see people. I mean, yeah, if you're looking at an octocopter, it's over your backyard. It can probably catch you without your swimsuit on, and you wouldn't want to be seen. But when we're talking about a drone that's 2 miles in the air, we're talking about a video feed that looks like the kind of video games they used to have, you know, before they became realistic. You're looking at something where you can see that there's people there and you can see relative size and so on, but you can't really, you can't see who it is. You can't, the only way you know who it is because there's information from an informant or because they actually, people said this in Pakistan when I was there, and I didn't, well, I won't say I didn't believe it. I wasn't sure because they were denying it. The United States was denying it. And they were talking about how brilliant these feeds were on the drones and how easy, you know, how they could see everything. But what the people said there is that they were getting chipped, is what they called it. And then it turns out, it hits the news a year later, that indeed they were using cell phone chips to track people. Well, you know, you can drop a cell phone chip in somebody's pocket. You can drop it on their front steps. You can give your phone to your kid to carry to school that day because you want them to call you back. There's all kinds of ways that those chips can be where they shouldn't be and wrongly identify someone. So on top of the fact that I don't think, you know, my understanding of U.S. law is that, you know, you get due process. And despite what Eric Holder said about due process not necessarily being judicial process, it seems to me that Americans, as long as I've known, have assumed that due process was indeed a judicial process. And to now be targeting people with no due process, and then on top of that, to be using a way to identify them that's like almost random, that can easily drift to the wrong person, is insane. It's just unconscionable to be using violence. What if someone were walking around in this country, you know, with a gun, with a sight that might show you what you think you're looking at, and actually it might have a video feed in it, and you might think you're seeing something different than what's going on. I mean, it's, you know, it's totally, the information that these drones rely on is totally unreliable.
You know, that's the part, the frightening thing. And then for the military perspective, and I'm going to put my hat on now as a retired Army officer, an NCO. Well, yeah, hey, I want that drone up there doing surveillance to protect me. But then I find out that the surveillance in the picture they're getting is not quite accurate. And then the next thing I find out is they went and as they've done over and over again, and we know it happened, and I've got the report in Afghanistan, they had a drone attack and attacked an Afghanistan wedding party. And then all of a sudden, well, it's just an error. We're sorry. I mean, sorry for murdering some people that have absolutely nothing to harm or any way to harm you whatsoever. I mean, how crazy does it have to get? I mean, Yemen, Afghanistan, Somalia, the Balkans, you know, up in the Soviet Union. I mean, their own nation where we're now attacking and straightening it across. I don't know. Yep. It seems to me like they've gone nuts. When you talk to these military personnel that are involved in this, what sense did you get from them?
Well, Doug, here at Hancock Air Base, which is the home of the 174th Attack Wing of the New York State National Guard, we don't talk to the military personnel on the base. They are so sequestered, so cut off from us behind high fences with barbed wire and armed guards, that they've done everything they can to keep us from talking with the personnel there. In fact, they won't even release the names of the personnel on the base. You know, that's classified information. So there's very little information actually leaking out because it's such a highly sensitive classified situation. What we try to do is, twice a month, we go out to the base with our signage, you know, drones fly, children die, at shift change, in hopes that when the personnel drive off the base, you know, some of them will see our signs and give some thought to what they're actually doing. So it's very hard for us to get to, you know, active duty military. So part of what I've been doing lately is linking up with Veterans for Peace, know, these are veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq, because they've got the real deal from their own experience. This is how we can learn about conditions over there.
Yeah, I mean, as a military guy, when I look at it, and we're fed all this lineable, and I was involved in developing and putting it together, and then in order to belong to the group, belong to the party, in other words, go drink with these guys and have a lunch every day, you have to go along with the nonsense. And you're fed stuff that you, all of a sudden, the reality of what you think is real versus what you've been fed totally disrupts your entire mind process. And, I mean, we've seen that from Vietnam. Judy and I, you and I discussed that from the Vietnam era. I mean, all of us went to Vietnam, were totally lied to. We know today that it was all total lies. And yet the Vietnam veteran, just like the current veteran, is so bought into the system and so bought into it that he can't even start to look at the reality of what war is doing and how these wars were even justified to begin with.
Yes, and, Doug, I see that, you know, like you'll see Vietnam veterans are sort of people that went to war around the same time I was, like, at the same age as I was. And so, you know, we saw our friends go off and come back. And now many of them that I meet that seemed okay, seemed fine when they came home, you know, had a nervous breakdown when they were 50 or something like that because they couldn't fully suppress it. And now I see these young men coming back from Iraq, and they have drinking problems, they have social problems. Some of them, there's an incredible number of suicides and other problems that come up for these guys because they were sent out without really understanding what they were going to be doing and without really understanding the context. So. And once they're there, of course, they have to survive. And it's a terrible thing to do to our youth. With the drone pilots, it's an issue as well. And, you know, I was going to say at Niagara Falls base, which is a little looser, and we've only, Ed's been there when I've been there, and there has been some hostility towards protesters standing by the drive with people coming and going. But I can say that I had an experience, a very moving experience with a young man. We were protesting, and he read this list of names of the people, of the children killed in Pakistan. And he was just so upset. He was like speechless, and I didn't realize what was going on. So I said, well, you know, I know it's a lot of kids. It's really sad. And he said, no, you don't understand. He said, I'm a drone pilot. And then he just turned and walked away. And he looked back over his shoulder and he said, I'm really sorry, and kept on going. And I felt, you know, like that was the first time he really understood what's going on from his job. And it is so unfair to set someone up to do a job and say, oh, you know, you can be sure of this and you can be sure of that, and you're doing the right thing, and so on, and have them find out later that the background information they have is incorrect and that what they're looking at isn't what they think they're looking at. And so there's more that's wrong with drones. I mean, it's enough that it is a moral outrage for the United States to be going around the world assassinating anybody who you know, they call it a threat, but when you're talking about low-level, you know, militants or guys who are maybe fighting to protect their village or who are, you know, involved in political struggles that are local to their homes, and those are the ones that, you know, are, hey, okay, this is a real militant. And then from there you move on to the wives and the children that are standing around and the factory workers that they thought were, or the wedding attendees. They thought, wow, there's a big group of people making a lot of noise. They must be bad guys. I mean, imagine if they did that here, you know, if it wasn't safe for people to stand in the street and, you know, shout. And if you never knew if the guy, you know, who's mad at you for whatever, is going to drop some chip on your porch, you know, It's just really horrible. But then you add to that the fact of the terrible burden we're putting on our own youth, and the fact that it's one thing to fly a plane and you're still following orders, but you at least have a chance to, at some point to think about what you're doing. And it's another to be the one person in a crowd of five who has the least power and the one who's going to have to put his finger on the button. And it's just really a terrible thing all around.
I think when you were pointed out as we're preparing for the radio show and you brought up with and all those points right at which I think the foundation of PTSD from Vietnam onward with everything involved in everything is the moral injury. I mean, as you mentioned, you don't have the information. You don't know. You were lied to. You were brought into this whole party by indoctrination, and then you start finding out the reality. I mean, it hit me real hard from Vietnam and my work and Desert Storm and everything since. But what we're seeing today, and we hear it over and over again, I mean, the child and spouse abuse, the divorce rate, everything else is just staggering problems, much less all the medical problems. I mean, we know the drones definitely been using DU munitions. We know there's DU on the drones. You don't want all this stuff. We have all the other associated weapon systems that drones have been using. So the collateral damage from a drone strike, it's got to be just unreal. I mean, the collateral damage from a simple airstrike is staggering. And I think if you remember, Madeleine Albright said some years ago, you know, when all this is heating up again, the U.S. will accept collateral damages because that's just part of war. I mean, it's complete, to me, total nonsense. And that's the reason why the poor soldier that's coming back is falling apart around the seams.
Yes, I think it's a terrible thing. That we are doing to our own people.
And so much of the so-called intelligence that the decisions to assassinate someone is based on human intelligence, and you touched on this, Judy, in the region where people have their own agendas. You know, they may have their own grudge against a particular tribal person or just about, you know, a different faction. And so they finger them. They get the bounty from the U.S. And that person that was fingered, that was killed, may have had nothing to do with any kind of threat to the U.S. Now, and the other thing is that the folks making the decision to kill another human being have very little knowledge of the culture of the people they're dealing with. They may not even realize that when they send a Hellfire missile into a compound, maybe they've been observing it for a few hours, but they don't necessarily observe that there's women and children in that compound, because in Islamic culture, women in particular are kept under wraps. So many women have been killed in compounds, and the pilots have no idea, the operators have no idea that they were there, despite maybe many hours of observation, keeping that compound under observation.
So I think you're right on the money on that, because from my experience over there, the thing what we call a compound is nothing but a normal way they live. Because of the desert environment and everything else, and because of the fact that they want to keep out of observation, what we call a compound wall is normal construction. That's just like having a big row of bushes or a big fence around your property, except they build it with walls. And so we call a compound, which is nothing but a standard home. And I saw this firsthand experience when I was over there, where we were blowing these places up and calling them military installations, and all it was somebody's house.
It's really bizarre, because, and I think they do it on purpose, and it bothers me that the press does this all the time. I've been fighting this use of the word compound for a long time, because I've spent time in Iraq and in Pakistan. I saw the same thing. You know, everybody lives in a compound. The school is surrounded by a stone wall. And if you think about it, if you look around, what else do they have to build anything out of? It's not like here where, we have to beat back the weeds most of the time. They don't have anything to build with other than stone or cement. And so, naturally, you want your house to have walls around it. And you, given they have extended families in these places, so yeah, it's kind of big. It's a little bigger than, you know, my little ranch house. But of course, because there's three families living in there, there's three brothers and maybe their parents too, and they each, you know, they each participate in the family in that space. All of their children are there. Their wives are there. It's a very different lifestyle than Americans envision. And so using the wrong language confuses people. And it's very bothersome. It's very bothersome to me when you try to discuss this with people that they just totally don't get it. You know, that... that this is culturally different. One of the most upsetting things to me when I heard about it was the drone strike that happened because the people got out of their car and ate lunch and then prayed and then got back in their car. And the people who decided to go forward with the strike said, well, I mean, only a militant would do that, would get out of their, you know, would pray after lunch. Whereas that's the culture there. Everybody does it. So, just really
some of our religious orders here, whether you're looking at a priest or a nun or other one. I think when we're looking at this stuff, and I want another quote here, and I'm pulling this up from, you know, military stuff. Former Joint Chiefs Chairman General James Cartwright, now retired, endorsed the use of remotely piloted aircraft, the drones, but in a blunt moment he added this, quote, I'm concerned we might have ceded some of our moral high ground, end quote. You know, what is this involved? I mean, I thought the United States was supposed to be out there for freedom, justice, and so-called the American way, you know, good old Superman stuff. But all this stuff has been aimed at who has overall economic control and resource control, and any tool that's available to kill, destroy, or acquire the ground seems to be somehow justified. And for me, I don't get it. I mean, I don't see how anybody can. And as a consequence of that, I think all these guys that are doing this stuff, and we're seeing that, the PTSD and the suicides, as you mentioned, are staggering. I don't know, where does it end? What do we need to do? How do we end this nonsense?
Well, one thing, Doug and Judy, I think we need to realize that this whole idea of a war on terror, war on terrorism, is very phony. In fact, the U.S. is creating the terrorism in two ways. It's killing people, killing civilians for political purposes, which is the actual definition of terrorism, and it's creating blowback. It's creating enormous resentment in the regions where the drones are operating. And I'm sure the powers that be, the Pentagon, is very well aware of this, and I think it really serves their interests. It leads to perpetual war. And if you have perpetual war, you have perpetual profits for those corporations like Lockheed Martin that profit from war material, war weapons, war systems. So we want to keep the pot. We, meaning the U.S. Pentagon, wants to keep the pot boiling, and one very good way of doing that is killing, wholesale killing of civilians and non-combatants. The Reaper drone is a tool of terrorism.
Yes, and I think that, you know, I think people need to understand that, you know, they feel like, well, it's okay to use the drones because they're killing terrorists, and even if that were true, which it isn't entirely, the United States, if we wanted to end the terrorism, there's another thing that Ed didn't mention, which if I was in the service, especially if I was on the ground fighting for my life, would really infuriate me, is that U.S. allies fund and recruit the people that we refer to as terrorists, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Al-Nusra in Syria, ISIS in Iraq and Syria, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, in Somalia, we've got Al-Shabaab, all these groups that the United States claims to be fighting with the drones are funded and recruited by our own allies, and something to remember is with the Saudi king visiting here right now. I think, I don't know if he's gone back yet, but he's been here for nearly a week, if he's still here. Here's a guy who is fomenting the people, the terrorism that the U.S. says that they're fighting all over the world. Meanwhile, we're selling them weapons so that they can go into another country with air power and kill as many people as they want in Yemen. And in fact, in Yemen, what they're doing is they're facilitating Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula to gain more territory, because they're killing off the people in Yemen who, and they're targeting the people in Yemen who were the most effective at fighting Al-Qaeda there. And now the United States is actually supposedly, opposed to or at war with the only people that have been effective on the ground in fighting with ISIS. And yet they want us to be so afraid of ISIS that we'll allow them to send drones and possibly men on the ground. There's a bunch of men on the ground in Iraq anyway, supposedly to help with the fight for ISIS. At the same time, they're instigating the Kurds to be at even further than they already are, at odds with the Iraqi government. And they're generally fomenting disorder politically as well as, and economically, as well as through this kind of senseless random bombing that the drones do.
I think one of the things, and I have to go back to Desert Storm because I was involved in this, I remember when we were getting ready for the February 28th, 1991, and the discussion of the ceasefire and everything, and I still got the pictures, and the idea was we're going to have a ceasefire, but we're going to leave Saddam in place. And all that was done and stopped because he was the only thing that was holding that whole region together because of all the warring factions and everything, and then we continued to destroy everything until it all totally came apart. Now, one thing that's happened in the last 96 hours is U.S. military is now sending military troops back into Iraq with all the chemical biological warfare equipment and techniques that I helped develop and teach and train and utilize before along with other buddies, because supposedly ISIS has used chemical weapons. Well, the only reason chemical weapons got into the Middle East to begin with is because U.S. Army shipped them to them. I was in a bookstore this afternoon, and on the bookshelf, they had a copy of Schwarzkopf's autobiography, It Doesn't Take a Hero. And I looked at the dealer, and I said, hey, are you interested in American history? You want to read a paragraph? And they read the paragraph about the decision we made and how Iraq got the chemical weapons from the United States and our decision to blow them up. And they just stood there stunned. It was sort of like, here's the information. It's out there for a bunch of us, but most people ignore it because, number one, it doesn't fit into their order of life. Number two, they don't want to deal with the truth. And number three, they don't want to have to take any action once they learn. Something really wrong all the way around.
Well, I think we live in a bubble in this country. I mean, it's the mainstream media doesn't help us to really understand how the world works. And we have a very different view of the world than people outside our bubble because we're so sheltered. We've never endured the aerial terror, the aerial bombardments that, other peoples have endured. So I think this undermines whatever empathy we might have for people that are undergoing this terrorism from the sky. And it leads us to be very easily manipulated and managed by the powers that be, who own the mainstream media that we consume so easily and readily and non-critically. Our school system does not encourage critical thinking. It encourages a certain brand of patriotism, mindless patriotism and nationalism, which, like sexism and racism, is one of these real toxic things that we just absorb in our mother's milk in this culture. We need to be much more critical of our own culture and of the power structure that manipulates things here in the U.S. and get alternative sources of information than what we have.
I think that's critical. Let's talk about this for a moment. The way I understand it, and you guys can probably some more also experience, the drone aircraft will be flying from some isolated airfield, which is under U.S. control or under a foreign nation's control where they're allowing the U.S. to fly. That drone is radio and operator controlled. They got video and radio control. But that pilot could be any place. Say, for example, at Hancock or up here in northern Wisconsin at Volk Field, or at, I know for sure, over here in Indiana, and also there's several places here in Illinois where they are at. But they're flying them from thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
So they have no observation of anything, as you said. They don't know what they're really looking at or what they're really attacking.
Right.
So it just doesn't friggin' make any sense at all. So then this poor guy is out there, and when he gets done, he's gone out there and he's just killed a wedding party, as you know has happened, or children, or men, women, or whatever, a group praying, or assassinated somebody just because we didn't like them. And then they're going to get off and they're going to go back home. So they're, say, they're living, you know, right there in Syracuse someplace. So they got to go back and their kids are going to school, and all of a sudden dad comes in. Well, they can't tell the kids what they've been doing. Dad just killed a whole bunch of people without justification, without provocation. And he thinks he's the best thing next to sliced bread until a few minutes later, all of a sudden he realizes, oh my God, what did I do?
Well, I think not being able to talk about it, that would be really hard for me. Of course, I like to talk. But and I think it's hard for anyone to have these traumatic experiences. I think it's a, you know, fact of psychology that if someone has these kind of traumatic burdens on their consciousness, that to not be able to talk about it creates a wound that festers. And you can, by not talking about it, you know, you can somehow not acknowledge it for a certain amount of time, but sooner or later, the pain will come to the surface.
Yeah,
you know, it's interesting that, like, at Creech Air Base out in Nevada, which is a sort of a really major hub for the drone war here in the U.S., they've had to hire more therapists and counselors and chaplains to sort of deal with the operators who are starting to ask questions and have qualms. And I guess the role of these professionals is to sort of say, well, don't worry about it, you know. The role probably seems to be to kind of help the operators feel okay about the dirty business they're involved in.
See,
now,
that's
you think
why
a chaplain, for example, would
why
have some sort of spiritual
because
moral
what
compass.
Kind of...
But in fact, the chaplains are paid for by the military. And if they want to continue in their work, you know, they better hew the line. So even our spiritual counselors get corrupted by this whole process.
Amen. I think you're right on the money. You know, the counselors and everything supposedly treating PTSD have totally failed. You've got, right now, the latest data is over 60% of the Vietnam vets are having serious problems with PTSD. OIF, OEF, and Desert Storm absolutely are. And they keep coming down with psychotropic drugs, and as you said, and this is from personal first-hand experience, you go into them, and the conversation revolves around accepting this as gospel truth. Not where you get into an in-depth discussion about the reality and the horrors and the ethical quandary that really is. And so nobody's getting served right, and then you get child and spouse abuse and suicides, and they're sick and they can't get their medical care. I mean, that's why we lost Paul Lyons. You know, it's coming up on the anniversary of his suicide. He was co-host of this radio show. He gave up all hope because of the lies, and he tried to get people help, and he couldn't get people help, and he couldn't get help for himself, and reached the absolute limit of no return. I mean, these drone pilots, I fear they're going to be the worst casualty of all in the future for PTSD. Would you guys agree?
I think it's going to be a serious social problem, and even more because of everything we've said, but beyond that, as it is, they're having trouble recruiting enough drone pilots, as so I'm told, and it's just not a very sexy job for an Air Force officer. And so they're going to lower the qualifications in terms of education, in terms of, aptitude and so on, because essentially it's not going to matter that much. I've been in corporations where they do that, and it's very annoying. in terms of even in terms of expecting people to do jobs that isn't their area of expertise, even though they might be really good at something else. And by doing that, though, they place more and more people into the position who are not qualified to deal with the issues that it's going to bring up and who have no resources, because at that point, if they lower the bar and they pay less and they, as already they've made it so that drone pilots don't get as many perks, for instance, in terms of education, in terms of some other things, in terms of time off, for instance, as other Air Force officers. What they're doing is they're creating basically a group that's in servitude. And it's not a good thing, even when all you're doing is boring paperwork and you're in that position. It's very stressful to be so unempowered. And to add to that the fact that you're actually killing people is just mind-boggling. So I do think that this is a group that is ripe for trouble.
We've got about 4 minutes left.
I certainly agree, Judy. And just a few weeks ago, the Pentagon made it very clear that they expect to expand largely their drone fleet, which this whole process of sort of reducing standards and so forth kicks in all the more. And why would they want to expand their drone fleet unless they want perpetual war and global control, global hegemony, which really seems to be what the drone is all about, is control over other countries and other countries' resources so that the U.S. can continue on its consumer binge of just wasting more and more resources. And it's not only the U.S. people that waste resources and consume and consume and consume religiously, but it's the U.S. military is one of the main consumers of fuel and other resources. It's the U.S. military that needs this fuel that leads them to invade other countries and undermine the sovereignty of other countries. And the drones fit right into that picture.
We had about 4 minutes left here, guys. What can people do? I mean, what can a civilian do, and what can a member of the military do? I mean, give some real good suggestions for the last 4 minutes as we wrap up this program.
Education, for one thing, there's a striking report called Living Under Drones, compiled by the Stanford and NYU law schools. They went over there with a team to interview survivors from drone attacks. It's very well documented, very well written. It'll give you a good picture of the realities on the ground. And you can download that free, livingunderdrones.org. That would be a very good place to start.
Yes, and I also think that people who do understand that this is a problem need to, like, step up and start talking back to the government. And this is something maybe I'm just all excited because we actually seem to be making a difference in terms of the Iran Accord being signed off by Congress. But it's questionable how much control we have of our government right now, but it's guaranteed that if we don't try to assert some control, then we aren't going to have any. So this is our government. We own it. The same with the military. According to the American Dream, which most of us grew up reading about and thinking about and believing in, we own the government and the military. It's there for our use. And so as a people, if we want peace, and I tell you that there haven't been any big demonstrations or showings of people on that front lately, but when you actually ask people, when you see how many people come by and agree with you, most Americans want peace. And most Americans understand that security requires peace. So to be the fire starter, the warmonger of the world, is clearly not a way to have peace. And we need to, like, over and over again, everywhere we can, let our government know that. Because the resources that should be educating our children and securing us here in terms of problems like climate change, where we're going to see some really serious issues across this country very soon, We need to keep telling them over and over again that we want peace and we want to use our resources to make this, you know, to solve our own problems, not to exacerbate other people's.
Let me just say one more thing here. A major problem is it's not only the United States, but also Israel. Israel is on the cutting edge of drone technology, and they use drones over Gaza on a 24/7 basis, which is the largest open-air prison in the world. If we could lobby the U.S. to stop giving Israel several billion dollars a year for military aid, which some of that money, of course, goes into the development of drones, we'd be way ahead of the game. And it's not just to try to get peace, but a just peace. Justice can't be forgotten when we talk about working for peace.
I think the thing that frightens me is Israel definitely has the nukes that the U.S. gave them, and they will pop them at the drop of a hat. And somehow we got to stop this. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Ed, I can't even say enough. I mean, you guys, Judy, you two have been fantastic. Thank you for coming on. And let's keep an open communication, information. If you got information and resources, please get it to me so that I can get it posted up on the website so people can go and look. God bless you, and thank both of you. Thank you very, very much. And good evening,
thank
ladies
you,
and gentlemen.
Doug.
Thank you very much, Doug. Glad you're fighting the good fight out there.
Really?